This is Joseph Gervasi. I'm here with Joe Gennaro of the Dead Milkmen and many other bands. Today is March 7th, 2013. We're doing this interview at the Mariposa Food Co-op in beautiful West Philadelphia, and this is part of Loud Fast Philly. Hello, Joe.
Hey, Joseph.
So I guess we'll start. You want to tell me year you were born and where you were born?
Year 1962. The city of Coatesville, and a hospital that is no longer there.
Okay. And what was the Coatesville? Did you grow up in Coatesville?
No, I grew up in a little town called Wagontown, adjacent to Coatesville. It's in Pennsylvania, Chester County.
Okay.
Kind of bucolic. Mm-hmm.
So how was life there in your young days?
It was pleasant. You know, it was the life. Mm-hmm. Great place to raise kids.
Right.
There really was a cow field across the street, right across the street from our house. A
pasture of cows. Did you get to hang out with the cows ever?
And, no, not really.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't really hang out with them.
So, young Joe, what music are you listening to, or what sort of books are you reading, you know, in your kind of formulative years prior to punk?
Prior to knowing about punk.
Yeah.
One of my earliest memories of reading a book about music was when I was in junior high school. I ordered a book about the Byrds. And the reason I ordered it is because it came with a record.
Mm-hmm. A book about the Byrds, the top movie? Or
Byrds, B-Y-R-D-S.
The band.
We had in elementary and junior high school, we had this thing called Scholastic Books. I don't know if people still have it, but
yeah, I had it when I was a kid. I don't know.
Yeah, so the teacher would pass out the list of books you could order, and we'd tick off the ones we wanted. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
pay for them, and then get mm-hmm. you know when the order came around. And we also had free reading time. I don't remember exactly the frequency. Maybe once a week, or there would be a time allotted that everybody could read their books, whatever they wanted to bring it to read.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I ordered this one because it came with a record, and I love records. And it was a biography of the Byrds. It came with a record of EP, a 7-inch EP with 4 songs.
Mm-hmm.
Two of which, if I remember, were Bob Dylan songs. And that's how I learned who Bob Dylan was, and I went and
got. So what was it, like 8 Miles High, or, you know,
8 Miles High was on there, My Back Pages.
Yeah.
So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star, mm-hmm. and Chimes of Freedom. Those were the songs. I remember them.
Yeah.
All 4 songs. Really good songs, too. And that was my introduction to both the Byrds, and then that's the avenue I took to learning about Bob Dylan, and I just fell in love with the Bob Dylan records I bought.
So you were in elementary school?
No, I was in junior high school.
Junior high, okay, yeah.
And I liked the Beatles, too. You know, I listen to radio, I listen to Top 40 radio, I listen to music, and I loved records. People gave me records. My uncle had a jukebox in a restaurant he owned for a while, and I remember he gave me the records that would get thrown, otherwise get tossed.
Mm-hmm. Did so they get had really a collection scratchy of, at that point? Like, by the time you
They weren't too scratchy, but there's, I would probably ruin them myself. But I remember, you know, records like Judy in Disguise.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Hey Joe by The Leaves. These are singles that I got out of his jukebox. So that's my early years and with music, and one of those records was a Beatles record. And it was in the jukebox, and I loved that one.
Was it a particular, I mean, you remember which one it was?
Yeah, it was Hello, Goodbye, I Am the Walrus. And eventually, by the time I got to high school, my favorite artists were Bob Dylan and the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And I gravitated towards, you know, the peripheral thing, like the other bands that are sort of on related, like The Band. I like the band.
Mm-hmm.
things like that, and then just Beatles solo projects. And
right, chiming Rickenbackers.
Chiming, yeah. And the Burns and things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All that 60s kind of stuff. So I was sort of stuck in the 60s and in the 70s.
Yeah. Kind of like Big Star. So now, was the coming of punk something that you were cognizant of at the time, and was it something that was kind of on your range?
The first awareness I had of it was catching, just by chance, a news story of it. Was sort of had the Sex Pistols in a really brief thing on TV of them performing. Mm-hmm. And I forget exactly the context. I don't even remember what channel it was on. And my parents were watching, and I just happened to see it. And that just clicked with me. I was like, I gotta find out more about this mm-hmm. kind of music. And I go to the library, our Chester County Library, and read, because I liked record. I'd always read a High Fidelity and Stereo Review magazines mm-hmm. in the library specifically for their record reviews to see. And Stereo Review, I remember, was pretty cool about reviewing the punk and new wave stuff, so I'd take their lead, and if they like something, then I'd go search it out.
Was it possible to find these sort of things in that kind of area?
Yeah, actually. I found Ramones and Clash. I found all this stuff in Sam Goody's record shop in the Exton Square Mall, believe it or not.
Nice.
And a friend of mine, this guy named Tom, who also went to school at where I went to school, worked at it there sometimes, and he would give me recommendations as well. Mm-hmm. But maybe he had some influence on what they stocked, I don't know. But he was into punk. He was really the only other person I knew in school that like dressed like a punk. I didn't dress like a punk. Right. Or he had this kind of new wave punk kind of dress to him, and which I thought was kind of brave. Mm-hmm. But
did that not go over well with your fellow students?
I don't know. I don't even know how much. I tried to get some of my friends to like the Ramones, and they didn't take to it. Mm. Like, a friend of mine who liked the Beatles, I thought, well, who might like the Ramones? I remember lending him Road to Ruin, which is the first Ramones record I got. No, Rocket to Russia, that was the first one I got. That's the one I lent to him. And he was just like, whatever. It's like, so the music that would, I mean, it really excited me, that record. Mm-hmm. I love, it kind of reminded me of the stuff I like from the 60s jukebox records I liked.
Kind of stripped down.
Stripped down, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Basic.
Not.
3 or 4 chords.
8, 9 minute songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not that I, you know. I tried to give Yes and Pink Floyd a chance. It didn't really gel with me at that particular time, the prog rock. Mm-hmm.
So are you aware of the sort of the magnitude of this movement, and did something of it appeal to you, you know, other than the music, like something of, you know, the outsider status or the politics of it or something like that?
Yes, the politics appealed to me, like the Clash. Probably through my parents, I was more left-leaning. I read Mother Jones magazine when I was in high school. I had a subscription to that. So I was on the left side of things back then. The politics appealed to me of the Clash.
Right. So what's the point where you start to come into, say, going to shows or forming a band that, you know, is connected to this?
When I moved to Philly to go to Temple.
And what year is this about?
It's 1980.
Had you been to Philadelphia before?
It was late 1980. Yeah, I went. I went to Philly to never to see a live show, mm-hmm. But I did go to see movies a couple times. I don't remember if I went. I don't think at the TLA now. The first time I went to the TLA was when I was in college, but there was like a Beatles film festival at, I think, the Tower Theater mm-hmm. in like 79 or maybe 78, one of those years, I forget. I went with one of my best friends, my Beatles friend, mm-hmm. Beatles fan friend.
Right.
there weren't too many people in the late 70s that would admit to liking the Beatles in high school.
Yeah, it seems like strange that it's only, you know, so few years later.
Yes, but they were, it was like considered nerdy, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I went to Philly then, but I didn't know that they were hardcore shows or punk shows. I didn't know anything about that until I went to college.
Did your early visits to Philly leave any particular impressions on you? Did you have a certain feeling for what, you know, what the city was like at the time, or how it, you know, made you feel coming into it?
Yeah, it's, you know, like any first time in a big city, I was impressed with how much traffic there is and how fast the traffic seems to go. It's you get used to it after a while, but when you first come to the city and how tall the buildings are and things like that.
Right.
I remember somebody telling me, when I, you know, first time I was walking around downtown with a friend, from college, told me stop looking up at the, I was like looking up the buildings and looking up like, wow. So don't do that because people will know that your target, you're not from around here.
Yeah. So you come in for college, and is that when you start to become aware of this kind of, you know, underground scene within the city of Philadelphia?
What's that again?
When you came in to live here, you know, at Temple as a student in the early 80s, is that when you became aware of the fact that there was this underground music scene in the city?
Yeah. Yeah, a friend of mine invited me to go with him to see, I think it was Autistic... Sadistic Exploits and Autistic Behavior and Stickmen. It's like no out-of-town bands, all local bands, none of whom I've ever heard of before.
But where was the show?
I think it was at some place called Elk's Lodge. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure of the year. It might have been 81 or 82. I don't remember exactly.
What did you think of those bands when you saw them?
I love the Stickmen. I was just completely... blown away. It was like nothing I've ever heard before, and it was so energetic, and I bought their record when it came out. Slightly disappointing with the record compared to live shows, but I saw every live show that I could see by them, and and I played the record a lot too. I liked all of the show. I was impressed by the number of people at the show. It's like the size of the scene that I had no idea about, and the way people dressed.
Did you feel like an outsider in this world?
Yeah, completely outsider. Mm-hmm.
And did you want to kind of be more integrated into that world? Okay. I imagine that at some point you sort of, at least to some degree, were. Did you, as you started going to the shows, did you begin to feel more comfortable, you know, get to know different people, you know, feel like you were a part of this
thing? Yeah, I was always a quite socially awkward person, even in college, high school, college, and... so I wouldn't be, I would never, it would take me a lot to approach someone or even talk to someone. Mm-hmm. So if I would go to a show on my own, which I did from time to time, I'd just, if someone didn't approach me, I'd just be there totally by myself the whole time.
Right.
But still kind of in my own head, but enjoying it nevertheless, but I couldn't really,
yeah. So when did you start to...
integrate myself.
Yeah.
That way.
So what, you eventually started to be in bands, or was Dead Milkman your first band, or were there...
It was.
Okay. So how did that come to start to, you know, how did that come together?
Well, the seeds of the Dead Milkman were planted when I was in high school. And I made tapes, cassette tapes with my neighbor for fun. We would ad-lib comedy sketches on tape. Mm-hmm. We plan out what the scene was going to be, and then record it, and
who were you influenced by? Like, what comedians or performers?
I liked the Monty Python, the Steve Martin. I had some of his albums. I listened to Dr. Demento too. That was another radio show I listened to. Mm-hmm. And another, there's a show that came on after it. I don't even know what it was, but whatever show came on after it, after Dr. Demento, was on Sunday nights. They just played random comedy things. It wasn't Dr. Demento, but that's where I first heard Steve Martin and things like that. And I don't know. That was my influences. Monty Python and I guess largely.
Right.
And that's kind of what I was copying.
So that's were you calling yourselves, I mean, did you have, were you using the name?
We were called the J-Rock Jerks.
Okay.
But I started incorporating music into that and those tapes. And at one point, I came up with the concept of Jack Talcum and the Dead Milkmen. And I made a newsletter a fake fan club newsletter about this band called the Dead Milkmen. It was called the Jack Talcum Fan Club Newsletter. But Jack Talcum was kind of like this folk guy, obnoxious folk singer character, sort of based on Bob Dylan, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
And he met this the Dead Milkmen band, which is the punk band, and he integrated himself into that band in the backstory of the band somehow. Yeah. And sort of took the band over and formed what I was calling folk punk or punk folk or what I think I called it folk punk, which I thought was an hilarious combination of genres.
But ultimately, just like exists.
But now it's yeah. Right. I would never have guessed that that could be unhilarious and
right.
But it's real. But then it was that was the whole idea of the Dead Milkmen was Jack Talcum and the Dead Milkmen. So I had the story and I was writing the newsletters. To go with it, I decided to make a tape, so I invited Garth, my neighbor was named Garth, and a friend of his, and my brothers and sisters, whoever was around, and we recorded the tape. I think it was like the end of 1979, New Year's Eve, when most of it was recorded.
And you just distribute this so, to your
yeah,
friends or something?
Yeah, some songs that I wrote.
Because uh-huh.
I've been writing songs, too. Back in the days when I was getting jukebox records, I was fascinated with the whole concept of, you know, I looked in the records, and this was a song, like Lennon and McCartney are the songwriters for these songs.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that before I knew that they were actually members of the band The Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be a songwriter, so I'd been writing songs since I was in junior high school. And we recorded the tape and called it So Long 70s. And that tape, I made a few copies of it. Garth, my friend, gave it to Rodney, who became the singer, Rodney, mm-hmm. in high school. And I knew Rodney, but I didn't have any classes with him. Garth did. I knew him from sitting at the lunch table in 10th grade. I sat at the same lunch table that he sat at, and then that became our unofficial assigned seats for the rest of the year, and that's where I knew him from. And he heard the tape and then approached me waiting for the bus after school one day and said, "Hey, I like that tape you made, The Dead Milkmen. When's your next recording session? I would love to be in it. I play banjo."
So well,
he's really
punk.
He's really outgoing and really shy, so it's a good thing that he approached me. And I said, "Well, you know, whenever you want to have we can have a session this coming weekend if you like. Let's do it." And he came over with his banjo, and we recorded some songs, and that became folk songs for the 80s.
Nice.
So this is where our first, that's how Rodney became part of the act, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So I guess he moved to Philly at some point as well. Once he
yeah, eventually he went to college in Westchester, but we collaborated through the mail, through the postal mail.
He'd send tapes me lyrics back and forth.
Yeah, just we weren't that sophisticated. He sent lyrics. And we'd see each other anyway, every, you know, month or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd record music to his lyrics. Basically, that's the way a lot of it worked back then. He'd write lyrics. He wrote lots and lots of lyrics. Very prolific. And I would write music to as much of them as I could and record it and then let him hear it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one way we did that. And I was still making these fictitious tapes. Like I'd compile songs I'd recorded and just make, I don't know, I must have made 5 or 6 cassette albums of the band before it was an actual band, using like overdub.
You still have these in the archives?
I have most of them. I kind of went crazy after we broke up and I had a spell of just not I tossed some things, but I also just mailed some things out randomly to people who had mailed letters to the Dead Milkman.
Oh, so they just got like a piece of history. Yeah, exactly. Were you very distraught?
I was kind of distraught.
So there was like I don't want to skip too far in advance, but we'll go off and then we'll go back.
It's 1995. I'm talking about. So yeah. Some of them fell out of my hands that way.
Okay.
Some of them, but most of them I still have. Yeah.
Do you regret now having sent these things out?
I do. I regret one in particular. One tape that I will probably never get back again.
So you have no.
But some of them came back to me actually.
Oh,
like in digital form.
Right. Do they turn up on the internet?
Yeah.
Put them, okay. Yeah, well, I guess there is something good about that then.
Yeah.
We'll go back more towards the beginning. So when does the band begin to be, you know, the sort of band as we know it?
As we know it, well, that's how Rodney came about. I met Dave while in high school through his brother, Joe. His brother, Joe, lived in the same dorm as me, and I saw him move in with this great record collection and overcame my shyness and approached him and introduced myself.
Records.
Yeah, because of the records. And he had a mohawk and he was cool looking and punk and whatnot. And we got to be friendly and I mentioned to him that I wanted to start a band. I talked to him about this Dead Milkman thing and, you know, it would be great if we could find a bass player and a drummer and that would round things out. He said, my brother is a bass player. I'll put you in touch with him. So a week or two later, his brother came over to the dorms, and we hit it off famously. We wrote our first song together that night, and that was that.
Yeah.
And Dean came about not too long after that. I think Dave convinced me, I hated the dorms at Temple, he convinced me to move out into a house. So we found a place together in Manayunk. This is in 1982.
Manayunk. So close to me. Not that anybody listening to this knows that, but...
Exactly. And this is before Manayunk was as trendy as it became. But anyway, it was the cheapest place we could find to rent.
Not as many college kids growing up on their flip-flops.
Not yet. This is a 4-bedroom, 3-story house on Baker Street for $400 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we got another college friend of mine who was the person actually told me about the punk show. His name was Kurt, and he was way in, he knew a lot more about alternative music than I did, and he was like my knowledge base.
Mm-hmm. So were you absorbing, you know,
I absorbed
like a sponge?
Things from him, yeah. He was into things like The Birthday Party and Joy Division, all the stuff I had no idea, because stuff that wasn't covered by the Stereo Review, High Fidelity stuff. He was reading NME and The Big Takeover and zines, and he told me about, I had no idea there was a zine culture either before I met him. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we all moved in together. A friend from Dave's, my friend Kurt, and me, all four of us, into a house, and that was great fun.
Mm-hmm. So do you start playing live around the
time? Well, Dave and I played a lot, and Rodney would come spend weekends there, and we'd have big songwriting sessions, recording sessions, and whatnot. So a lot of the Big Lizard album was being written, and we didn't know it was going to be that album, but we were writing all those songs, recording them, and we were looking for drummers. We had a few auditions that didn't go well, but I think it was the third one. The third guy that tried out was Dean, and I knew him from, he was a friend of another college mate of mine, Dave, another Dave, not Dave Blood. This Dave was Dave Reckner, who eventually became the manager of the Dead Milkman. But Dean was one of his best friends, and he was going to school at the Art Institute downtown. And I don't know, he just came for an audition in our house in Manayunk, and it just clicked.
And then?
Yeah, just.
So what sort of clubs or venues, spaces were you playing, you know, in the early years in Philly? What was around?
Any show we can get. Our first show wasn't in Philly, it was in Harleysville. Uh, But I think our first Philly show was outside the Pine. It was on Pine Street on Antique Row. I think there's a place called Pine Street Beverage Room. I don't know if it exists anymore, but they hired us to play outside on like the block party that they were having on Pine Street.
Now, this is the first time you're really, you know, as a shy person, kind of going out in front of people and performing, right?
Yeah.
And how did you, were you able to kind of cope with that all right?
Well, I had a bout of stage fright before our first show, but once the show started, it went away. Plus, I wasn't the lead singer. Rodney is a great front man, and he took care of everything, basically.
Mm-hmm. So you just kind of like come up to sing?
Yeah, I would sing. I had a song to sing. Usually every show, I had one song to sing.
Right. So at the time, who do you think were some of the more interesting of the Philly bands in the punk or underground scene that you were, you know, playing with or interacting with?
FOD. Electric Love Muffin. I remember seeing them when they were still called the Sunshine State, actually. But they became Electric Love Muffin. I really like that band. it's a band called the Johnsons, who were acquaintances of ours.
I never heard them before. I mean, I know Electric Love Muffin, but I don't know the Johnsons.
The Fabulous Fondas, who I still see some of the I still see Bill from the Fabulous Fondas every now and then, because he's in a band with my roommate, and he was in the band Rodney had after the Dead Milk and Burn Which Burn. Those are the ones that come off that come to mind right away of the bands I liked.
So I guess of all the bands in the Philly scene, it seems like Dead Milkman took off far more.
Oh, there was Ruin, too. I remember Ruin.
Oh, yeah, you have Ruin. Yeah.
Can't forget him.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. But so Dead Milkman kind of went much further out into the world than most of the other Philly bands that were in the punk scene and certainly came to, you know, greater prominence. So how do you think why do you think that was?
I don't know. I know the Muffin toured and FOD toured, and from what I hear, FOD were more successful over in Europe. Why that was, I don't know.
I mean, none of those bands had like a video in rotation on MTV.
Yeah, I don't even know why that was.
So I mean, what's the story behind this? Like, how did this come to be?
The video?
Yeah, I mean, you made a video, you know, I don't know of any other Philly bands of the era that were making videos and that were playing on MTV. So you made something, it ultimately wound up there. How did that come to be?
Yeah, we made videos. We were going to put out our first record on our own, but the funding just evaporated. So we had a recording of 10 songs that we thought were album worthy, and we shopped that around, like sent it out to record label, like every record label we could find. Mostly didn't get any response, and when we did get a response, it was no thank you. Mm-hmm. And we saw that there was this record label in Philly called Fever Records, and Dave Blood noticed this, because he got a record, I think the band was called Get Smart, but I might be wrong. And on the back it said Fever Records, and the address was Philly. We're like, oh, this record company exists in Philly. And lo and behold, it's only a few blocks. The address is only a few blocks from where we rehearsed in South Philly. We were rehearsing on 9th Street back then. So, if I remember correctly, what we did, we brought our tape to him, to that address in person. Maybe a six pack of a beer or something, knocked on the door, and this guy answered. Colin Cameron was his name. Turns out he's a professor at Wharton.
Now he's not.
Yeah. He's a somewhat famous, I guess, research person in behavioral psychology or something like that. Yeah. But to us, this guy answers the door, and we explain to him what, or are you Fever Records? This is was an odd way to go about it, but this only information we had was his address.
Yeah, it beats money on postage anyway. A few blocks down the street.
And to make a long story short, eventually he agreed to put out our album if we would record some more songs, because the 10 songs we had were really short. He thought that's only EP worthy, and he wanted something album worthy. So he funded, I don't know, it was less than $1,000, but he funded for us to go back to the same studio and record another 10 songs, which we did. Mm-hmm. And that album became the Big Lizard in My Backyard. And where am I going with this story?
We're moving towards music videos.
He had on his label a band called The Effigies from Chicago, mm-hmm. who were hot in this label out in California, Enigma, who I think was a label that we actually sent our tape out to and either got no response or got rejected. They wanted The Effigies on their label. So he did a deal with them. Mm-hmm.
It was a package deal.
Package deal, P&D deal. Yeah. But it was like, take everybody, or that's how we got onto Enigma. It wasn't that we got a deal with Enigma, we got a deal with Fever, and right. they lucked into having us, whether they liked it or not, because of The Effigies, so right. we have them to thank. And they, through their deal, whatever it was, we had a deal with Fever, but their deal had it so that we make videos to promote the albums. That's what you did. MTV was one of the outlets to promote videos. They played MTV played videos back then, not unlike what they do now.
I do remember that. Yeah.
So the M stood for music.
Yeah.
And cable wasn't existing in Philly. I don't know if you know that, but
so this is what
when we were starting. Yeah, cable for legal reasons that the city council still hadn't decided on a franchise.
So what? So the suburbs had cable?
Yeah, the suburbs had cable. So I'd go out to my parents' house and watch MTV, or Rodney's parents, or even Dave's. And we would do that. We would go out to Dave's parents and have practice out there sometimes. And then get our fill of MTV, this crazy new thing. Uh-huh. Anyway, that's a diversion.
There are no diversions in the interview. They're all diversions.
So they would be part of the funding for the record. Is you there's some allotment to make a video for. So we did Hip, the Things Only Hippies, that got played on like this show. This is pre 120 minutes, but there was the show that happened on Sunday nights. I don't even think they played the whole video. They just played a little bit
what
of
show
it.
Was,
and we were like,
do you remember
happy
what show that was?
Like, oh wow, we're on MTV. I don't remember it, but it was some show on MTV on Sunday nights. But it was the precursor to the 120-minute show that we actually hosted, guest hosted once.
Nice.
And the next album, they gave us money to do Big Time Operator, and we didn't decide which songs either. It was like the record company decided the song, because they. So we did that video, and that got played a couple times. And by now, 120 minutes was a program that got played on it.
Who was the host? Was it Dave Kendall at the time, or was there somebody?
Yeah, they had different hosts. Maybe it was him. I don't remember names too well.
Yeah. I barely do, but that one just happened to pop up. Uh-huh. I figured I'd throw it out there.
And then the song that they picked for the fourth one, we didn't do a video for the first album. For the fourth album was Punk Rock Girl, which I thought was an odd choice.
Why did you think that was such an odd choice?
Because it's not the singer is Rodney.
Right.
And this one's me.
Yeah.
But whatever, we did the song. We liked the director of the previous video, Adam Bernstein. So we used him for that one too. And just like any other video, we figured it's going to get played once or twice on 120 minutes, and that'll be it. Mm-hmm. But who knows why this one got put into, I guess, rotation. And
so it was in rotation like regularly, right? Like,
well, they put it lightly at first, and there's a show called Dial MTV, and I'm not sure how that works behind the scenes, but supposedly they have this certain amount of time that you can call in and vote for your videos. But I don't know how the video, our video, got to be in contention on that program. But when it did, it it kept going up week after week until I actually reached number one in the dial.
So you beat, you know, Bon Jovi or whatever.
Yeah, it's not something crazy like that. Maybe people are alert. People are, they just, you know, they get a kick out of the video and they want to see this obscure band.
Yeah.
That's how it got on MTV.
So all of a sudden you're in great prominence, you know, clearly.
Yeah, we're in the middle of a tour when this is happening too. Yeah.
Is it a weird thing that you wind up suddenly coming, you know, to the fore where you weren't normally singing, and then, you know, is Rodney a little grouchy about
that
fact?
It's kind of disconcerting. Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
It was a little odd.
So I saw a video of you on, what is it, Club MTV, I think?
Yeah.
I mean, have you seen
that footage recently? And we actually said, the record company, I guess, put that all together and got us there. Who knows? Maybe somebody on the record company was dating somebody on MTV. Who knows how these things happen? Right. But the right thing happened at the right time, or the wrong time, depending on your perspective. I remember saying, "We don't want to." I remember saying, "No, we can't do this Club MTV. This is not our style of music, and it's not going to work." So we said no to it.
It works
several times.
Amazingly,
you can't say no is what the answer we got.
Yeah.
Like, not after, you can't say no. So we said, okay, well, if you can't say no, then we made these demands, like, we need a, I don't know, what Rodney's playing, what instrument is he playing? Some crazy
I don't
tuba think, or something, I don't know what it is.
So clearly you're not playing the song.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was what, Julie Brown, I think?
We got our friend Chris to throw rubber worms out into the dancers. We bought a bunch of rubber worms from fishing supply, and those were being thrown back up at us and at a downtown Julie Brown. Yes.
how does she
you
feel?
You barely
about
see them on the video, but
you see
she
mass
was upset.
Chaos.
She was on camera. She held herself up pretty well, but behind the scenes, she was upset. And it probably had something to do with us not getting played anymore. I don't know.
Oh, really?
I don't know if it did, but...
it is a fantastic piece. I mean, I've seen this thing, and it's pretty great. I can't imagine that any of the other bands...
And I'm sure they didn't show it more than once.
I think somebody taped it off of the actual broadcast, and it's kind of circulated around since then. You know, it's like, look how...
We wanted to use that, too, on our DVD collection that got put out in 2003. But it just... The record company wouldn't, the price, it was basically MTV put a ridiculous price tag on the footage, maybe to prevent it from being used, I don't know, maybe that's just what they do, and Ryko wouldn't do it, wouldn't go for it.
It would have gone over quite well.
Yeah.
So do you find, like, the Philly bands who were around at the time, are they kind of razzing you because you've kind of, you know, suddenly you're on MTV and you're doing these things?
Yeah, we got a little bit of that, but whatever.
Yeah. So things go on. I mean, clearly you've made many records over many years, and it's a tremendous lifespan for a band. I mean, how do you manage to keep this whole thing together? I mean, usually people's personalities begin to...
Well, we didn't. We actually broke up. But for one thing, one of the things that I think helped us stay together where other bands fell apart at the same time is that we were actually making money. We were making a living off of it, and that was our living. Mm. And I think if we had split, what are we going to do? We have to go find jobs. And
another worse
we don't want to do. We don't want to do that. This is the job of a lifetime. So to keep that job going, you can tolerate personality differences.
Right.
And there weren't that many, really. And from maybe I was living in maybe I had my head in the sand.
Right. So what precipitated the end of the band?
Personality difference, not necessarily, is not seeing eye to eye on the goals of the band, I think.
So what year is this that you initially...
It was at the end of 93. We had this tour booked for the Not Mature for Dick album, or EP, that spanned the end of 93 and into 94, and it was all booked all the way through till the spring. But the first leg ends right before Christmas, and the second leg begins, like, I don't know, in January, beginning of January. So we had this break, and at the beginning of the break, I remember Dean called a band meeting, and didn't say why, but turns out that the meeting was him announcing his departure from the band after the end of the tour. So he said, I'll finish this tour, but then I don't want to be in the band anymore. Right. You guys are welcome to replace
me. Continue on, yeah, right, without him.
So that to me was a bombshell, as was, I'm sure, to Rodney and Dave. After that meeting, I talked to Dave, and we talked about, you know, the other drummers we knew, and what our ideas were, what we can go forward. But then within a week, I think, Rodney came to us and said, you know what, I've been thinking as well, and I don't want to continue with the band after this tour either. I think that's my memory of the chronology of that. In between that, we're having discussions, the three of us, maybe about, well, I'm actually at this meeting, I tried to convince Dean to stick with it if we would, you know, not tour, because I knew his problem was that touring was too much time out of our lives. To make a living out of the band, we had to devote at least half a year to touring, and he had a wife and had plans to raise a family, etc. So what he really wanted to do was go back to school, and because he was a graphic designer, that's what he went to school for at Art Institute, and learn web. And this is when the internet was becoming fascinating. This is 93, is when you know, the early,
yeah,
you know, Rodney was into it then too. I think I was the only Dead Milkman that actually did not have a computer did not get on the internet. All the other three guys did, and they would talk about this. So that was a fascinating thing, and it's understandable that he would want to do that. But I thought, well, why don't we just become this local? We don't have to tour. We can sit tight in Philly and let people come to us if they want to see our shows, and we'll just make albums. Sort of like what the Beatles did when they stopped touring, even though they didn't play any shows at all.
Right. Now, Dave
was absolutely against that, because he loved the touring aspect the most, and he said, "Well, if we're not gonna tour, then I want to also do something else." So we were thinking, okay, replace Dean with another drummer, and we'll continue to be a touring band. But then Rodney came to us and said, "No, I don't want to do the touring anymore. It's you know, wearing me down too."
Wow. So that then.
So that's when we decided. Okay, we'll just end.
And then you lose your marbles.
We lose our marbles. Yeah, then I lose my marbles. But that was until 95.
Okay. I mean, what is the gap between like what happens in the years?
Well, we recorded our final album. We wrote it and rehearsed it and recorded it in 94. I mean, I got a job at a coffee shop.
Did you begin to look into starting other bands?
I was in another, I had a side project called Touch Me Zoo, but that also started to fizzle for personality reasons. Although, I think that band lasted probably longer than it should have, but we kept, it was like a revolving, it was the revolving bass player syndrome we had in that band,
right,
until it just ended. But yeah, I had that side project, and I was doing anything I could. Another friend of mine who was in a band with Dean called Baby Flamehead, Andy, approached me about putting a band together, and we did, and that was called Butterfly Joe. So he put that band together, and we made an album. I did all kinds of things. Maybe too many things all at once.
Right.
And actually wasn't a friend, he just kind of showed up on my doorstep, but I met him on the last show of the last tour of the Dead Milkmen. His name is Chris. We formed a band together called The Town Manager, so I had that going as well.
So eventually Dead Milkmen comes back together, though, at least temporarily. I mean, you do a reunion show, right?
We do, under unfortunate circumstances. We do a reunion show because Dave took his own life, Dave Blood, in 2004.
Did you know that he was
depressed.
Mm-hmm. So did you know that he was...
I didn't understand depression. I thought as well as I do now. But I didn't know that he was having a hard time of it then. But his mother had died, passed away a month before, and he was really close to her. And he was taking care of her. She had cancer. He was taking care of her right up until she died. But it still was a shock. So it wasn't... And I saw him, last time I saw him was at her funeral, and he seemed pretty together under the circumstances. He was holding himself together pretty well. So it was a total shock that he took his own life. Later that year, this is 2004, his brother Kurt, another brother of his, approached us, me in particular, about performing Dead Milkman songs at a memorial show that he and his brother Joe were putting together for Dave.
Mm-hmm. Where was that
featuring going? Like other bands that Dave liked.
Mm-hmm. Where was that to be held?
Ruin might have. That was at Trocadero. So, and Chris, my friend from the town manager, has helped in doing the logistics for that whole thing. So Kurt's idea was that we could play using another bass player. So all kinds of bass players that would be willing to sit in and play the songs. Mm-hmm. So I asked Dan Stevens, we called him Dan Drew, who was in the band Low Budgets with me at the time. Low Budgets are a band that formed after the town managers broke up. It was with me and Chris, the same person in the town managers. This guy who was going by Chris Peel Out. The Low Budgets was his concept, and he asked me to, instead of playing guitar, which is what I played in the town managers, to play organ. And Dan played the bass. So I asked Dan to play bass. I knew he was a huge Dead Milkman fan already. And it turns out he knew a lot of the songs better than we. He retaught us the songs as far as chords go.
Right. So, and it went over well.
And it went. We rehearsed a lot, and it went over well. And I think we did well for Dave's memory. Raised a lot of money for a suicide awareness prevention organization. And that I thought was going to be it. We played this show, this memorial show, 2004. But 4 years later, we got an offer to play a festival in Austin called Fun Fest.
Was this like a, was it a big like weekend thing, outdoor?
Yeah, it's like a 2 day, outdoor festival in November when it's really nice. In Austin.
Yeah, and really shitty here.
Really shitty here, so there's a good reason to go there.
Yeah.
And huge, like 3 stages, lots of bands. Also a stage for comedy acts.
Right.
So after a bunch of saying no, just like we did to Club MTV, mm-hmm. we got this. Come on, guys. I can make this worth your while.
Yeah, I can imagine the money was probably pretty good if it got you to the thing.
The money is like something we'll probably never earn before, or maybe never again. this completely ridiculous figure. Plus, I'll pay for your hotel. Plus, I'll pay for your plane.
Yeah, how can you turn this down? Say no to that? Right, right.
And the guy was saying, you know, there are bass players, there's like a dozen bass players in Texas, in Austin, that'll play for you guys. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, bass player isn't the problem. Problem is that we're not, you know, we have to, that wasn't the problem, but after the offer we couldn't refuse,
right.
We did the show, and it was so much fun.
So was there anything else after?
Why not keep doing it?
Was it?
Why not keep doing it?
So you did?
Other offers came through, too, that were really considerable for other festivals.
Right, so you took them up as well?
Yeah, we started to We started to.
But right now, is there? There's no. You're not performing now, though, right? Where are you?
Yeah, we are. We've been performing since.
Okay.
We just don't tour. That's the thing. We don't go on any real tours like we used to, because Dean has a family. But Dan, the bass player, he has a young family, 3 little boys, and unless we all have our date, we're kind of settled.
Right. So you've moved through many bands over the years, and you've managed to remain in a very, you know, ever-changing, crazy music business. I mean, even if it's based out of Philadelphia, you're constantly creating and producing and making records, which is pretty impressive. I mean, did you think that you'd be able to kind of pull this off, to this point, to this age?
No, I don't. I didn't give it any thought in that respect. I never thought that. I always hoped the Dead Milkmen would get back together again, but I kind of thought, because I'm sort of like this pessimist, I guess, that it's not going to happen. And then when Dave died, I thought, well, now it's definitely not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it did, and the way it did, and that Dan filled Dave's shoes so well, I never would have dreamed. And now we have our own record company, which is kind of what we wanted to do in the very beginning.
Right. So you had complete control, right?
Now we have complete control, which we didn't have then. It kind of worked out. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of glad. And we're actually pressing up physical records, which is insane to think. I never thought. I know that it's trendy hipster thing to like, but I was sad in the 90s when I found out Soul Rotation wouldn't be on vinyl, released on vinyl, because that was my preferred format even then.
Yeah. No, I think there's still great pockets of people all over the world who want a physical format, and the LP is like the most beautiful of all of them.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy though, but I agree that it's insane, but it's still fun to do.
So do you feel that you're generally, are you fairly happy in the position that you've, wound up in now? Life in general?
Yeah, I'm happy, middle-aged 50-year-old guy.
And you still live in Philly?
Pretty much.
That's good. Yeah. Super. Well, I mean, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks. It was fun.
Thank you.